Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. Immanuel Kant begins his conclusion at the end of part 3 of the Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics by talking about several absurdities. Ungereimheit is the term that he uses for absurdity there. Quite literally, things that don't rhyme, things that don't jibe together, and then it comes by extension to mean something that's nonsensical or absurd. And it's none of these are nonsensical in that we can't make any sense of them at all, but they're all kind of mistakes. They become absurdities when we think them through. So he begins by saying that the clearest arguments having been adduced in the previous sections, it would be an absurdity for us to hope that we can know more of any object than belongs to the possible experience of it. So why can't we know more of any object than what belongs to possible experience of it? Well, we encounter possible objects within possible or actual experience. That is what it is to be an object. It is something that we conceive of as being in space and time. And then he goes on and he says, or lay claim to the least knowledge of how anything not assumed to be an object of possible experience is determined by the constitution that it has in itself. So we can't actually penetrate to the things in themselves. They lie outside of experience by the very nature of what they are, and so we can't apply the categories and concepts that we use for experiential matters to them. Or we can, if we want to wind up in absurdity, right? And then a bit later, he's going to talk about other greater absurdities. He says it would be, on the other hand, still greater if we conceded no things in themselves. So even though we can't know anything about the constitution of things in themselves, even though we can't know more of any object than what is contained in possible experience, nevertheless, we're stuck saying that there are things in themselves. What exactly these are, we don't know, right? But we can't just throw them away or rule them out either. And he goes on and says a few other things here. If we were to declare, and then there's three things that he notes, our experience to be the only possible mode of knowing things. So we can't restrict knowledge or cognition to only experience, or our intuition of them in space and time to be the only possible intuition. Other modes of intuition are perhaps possible, maybe even to some degree imaginable, if not conceivable. And now notice the last one, our discursive understanding to be the archetype of every possible understanding. Kant is holding out the possibility that maybe our seemingly completely universal understanding is not such, right? And then he goes on and says, and to have the principles of the possibility of experience taken for universal conditions of things in themselves. And this is something he's talked about before. We have great knowledge now at this point, at least in the universal or general, about the conditions of experience. Things in themselves, we cannot apply that knowledge that we have to the things in themselves and say, aha, we've got this. And this is what dogmatism actually does, which leads then to skepticism, right? So we have, and we've seen this before in the Prolegomena, these sort of three isms, or we have three positions, you could say. Dogmatism, which is committing itself, committing the person who's making the claims to more than they actually do know. Skepticism, which arises as a counter to dogmatism, both in Kant's own view, sort of ahistorically and also historically as well. And then we have transcendental critique, that which Kant is providing in his own philosophy, which is going beyond dogmatism and skepticism both. But skepticism is an important moment in this, and Kant tells us that what does skepticism arise from? Metaphysics and the lawless dialectic of pure reason. And that's kind of a cool way to talk about it. And it's also kind of revealing, right? The dialectic, as we've seen in the discussion of the ideas, the psychological, the cosmological, and the theological, there is a kind of regularity or understandability to it, right? An intelligibility, but it can be lawless in that it is not going to be limited or confined by reason itself, as it should be. So what forms does this skepticism take? He says that, well, our principles which limit the use of reason to possible experience might become transcendent and the limits of our reason be set up as limits of the possibility of things in themselves. He brings up Hume's Dialogues on Natural Religion as an illustration of this. And then he says, if a careful critique did not guard the bounds of our reason. We'll come back to that. So he says skepticism arises, right? At first, it might merely to favor the empirical use of reason. Rationality is used with empirical experiential matters, right? Announce that everything that transcends this use as worthless, valueless, and deceitful, leading us astray. So, you know, this is something that we could find in classical skepticism of various sorts. We can also find this in David Hume. He says, you can reason about anything you like. Once you get beyond the realm of experience, you're on really, really shaky ground because you can imagine anything you like that way. So that's one way of going. And then he says, well, it can go even further. It can lead to doubting even the propositions of experience, right? That would be a real problem. Maybe we need to like rein in dogmatic reasoning about things. That's a prudent sort of skepticism. But we could also call into doubt, as for example, Descartes did, and so many others as well, the things that we do experience. Because how do we know that we can trust any of those? That's a big problem. And Kant here is actually going to talk about a confusion, a Verwirrung. He's going to use that term twice in Science, Wissenschaft itself, about reason. He says the confusion is that science cannot determine how far reason is to be trusted and why only so far and no further, right? So science, which is a use of reason, is not able to set limits, reasonable limits, if we want to be a little punny, limits that have their own basis in rationality itself, on reason. It can't provide an intelligibility to where reason can go and whether it can be trusted and why, in this respect, it can be, and in this respect, it can't be. And we should pause for a moment on this word science, right? So Wissenschaft, science, is a broader term than what in English we often confine merely to the natural sciences, along with mathematics, and then the social sciences, and perhaps some other things as well. We talk about computer science, for example, which is really concerned with technology and codes and hardware and things like that. Metaphysics itself is striving to be a science. So Kant here is using science in a broader sense, and this would actually lead to science in the very broad sense being able to rework what's previously been dogmatic metaphysics into something that could be satisfying. And so he says the only way we can clear up this confusion and prevent future relapses is through a critique, through the critical use of our reason, right? So he says, what does this lead us to? Well, we can't, as he says, beyond all possible experience, form a definite notion. Now, that should actually be concept, Begriff, that's the term that he's using there, of what things in themselves may be. But we are not, as he says, at liberty to abstain entirely from inquiring into them. So we're kind of stuck in the middle. We cannot actually form concepts definite concepts. We can form an indefinite concept of a thing in itself or things in themselves, but we can't resist them. We can't completely turn away from them, at least not if our reason is working, you could say. And he says, why is that the case? Experience never fully satisfies reason. It couldn't. The realm of experience is too narrow to fully satisfy this faculty of reason. And he says, in answering questions, it refers us further and further back and leaves us dissatisfied with regard to their complete solution. And so he says, we can gather this from the dialectic of pure reason, which has good subjective grounds. And now he's going to give us three examples of how this works, familiar to anybody who's read the earlier section. First, we have the psychological idea. He says, who can refrain from asking what the soul really is? And if no concept of experience suffices for that purpose, from accounting for it by a concept of reason, a simple, immaterial being, a substance, you can say, right? Even though we cannot by any means prove its objective reality. So we're inevitably attracted into thinking about the soul, or if you like, the self, whatever you want to call that substantial unity of consciousness. Then we have a whole bunch of ideas, as we saw before, the cosmological ideas, which are actually antinomies, and they are framed in terms of questions. He says, who can satisfy himself with mere empirical knowledge in all the cosmological questions of the duration, time, light, right, or beginning or not, and the magnitude of the world, freedom or natural necessity? That's the third one. Since every answer given on principles of experience begets a fresh question. Now, this is very interesting. Answering things sometimes doesn't answer them because it leaves new questions open, or it brings them to the fore for us. And he says, each of these likewise requires its answer and shows the insufficiency of all physical modes of explanation to satisfy reason. And then he comes to the third, what we call the theological idea, or the ideal of pure reason. He says, who does not see in the thoroughgoing contingency and dependence of all his thoughts and assumptions on mere principles of experience the impossibility of stopping there? Who does not feel himself compelled, notwithstanding all interdictions against losing himself in transcendent ideas, to seek rest and contentment beyond all the concepts which he can vindicate by experience in the concept of a being, the possibility of which cannot be conceived, but at the same time cannot be refuted because it relates to a mere being of the understanding, and without it reason must needs remain forever dissatisfied. So all these ideas that form part of the dialectic of pure reason inevitably arise for us, and the goal here then is to look at them in a critical manner. And part of that is not trying to actually resolve them and explain them away by saying, they don't refer to anything, there's nothing there. No, there's something that we're being drawn to. We just cannot, by the tools that we have available from the understanding, from our intuitions through space and time, through possible experience, we cannot account for them in that way, and we cannot determine those ideas in the ways that we can determine other concepts by use of the understanding. Reason is thereby drawn away from dogmatism, away from skepticism, into its critical and also transcendental usage, so that we can develop metaphysics into an actual science. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.